This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio, your voice in Vancouver. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Today, we'll look at two solutions to climate change that are worlds apart. Our main presentation is by Professor William Mumaw of Tufts University. He explains how we could cut greenhouse gas emissions by 75% using existing technology. Then, Satish Kumar, editor of Resurgence magazine, gives us a much different perspective on global warming. He offers solutions from India in his speech, Gandhi and Climate Change, coming up later in the program. How can we reduce the world's greenhouse gas emissions by 75%? A lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us, Professor William Mumaw of Tufts University gave this speech to hundreds of people attending a conference organized by the Massachusetts Climate Action Network on November 19, 2006. The title is, How Can We Utilize Technologies and Policies to Get Us to a 75% Cut in Global Warming Emissions? This speech is part of a double DVD set, a video of the conference, available from the MCAN website at www.massclimateaction.org. massclimateaction.org. The featured presentation was by Boiling Point author and journalist Ross Gelbspan. Don't miss that one. Here is an action plan to save our climate.
I'm going to introduce Professor Bill Mumaw. He's a professor of international environment and resource policy at the Fletcher School, Tufts University, where he directs the Center for International Environment and Resource Policy. He holds a PhD in physical chemistry from MIT and worked on molecular spectroscopy, photochemistry, and energy transfer. He is now a policy scientist who has served on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change since 1993. He works to identify energy and industrial technology and policy that can address climate change and distortions of the nitrogen cycle. He is also engaged in a project to understand and to improve the system of global environmental governance. And much to his credit, speaking to him a little earlier, he's not just one of these professors in their ivory towers who likes to pontificate about everything, but he has, in the homes that he has lived in, he has managed to cut the oil bill. What is that, 60%?
About two-thirds.
And he's building, designing a new home to be built soon that would have no net global warming gases emitted because of it. So on that note, please give a welcome to Professor Mumaw.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mark, I want to thank you for organizing this. I left the chemistry laboratory 19 years ago and entered the policy laboratory, where the chemistry is a good deal more complex, I have to say. Having wrung my hands, as many of you have, over global warming and the problems of climate change and their implications, to finally get to the point where there's an entire conference devoted to solutions is just heartwarming and exciting for me. So, let me thank all of you for engaging and for being here. There are two inconvenient truths. The first is that climate change is happening and that it will get worse. These are the data of the temperature record through 2005, and as you can see, 2005 is slightly ahead or just about the same as the previous record of 1998. And as you can see from the map, some regions have warmed enormously, particularly in northern latitudes, which creates this huge problem of the melting of the Greenland ice cap and other things. A recent report that's just been released by the Union of Concerned Scientists involving 14 independent researchers made estimates of what global warming is likely to be in the Northeast, in our region, right here. And it's quite stunning. There are two scenarios, a yellow one and a redder one. And you notice that the problem is that emissions, the rise of emissions in the higher scenario means that temperatures in this region could be 12 degrees warmer by the end of the century. That's just staggeringly different. That puts us basically into South Carolina. I urge you to go to the UCS website and to listen to Peter Frumhoff today and just see the dramatic graphics that have been put together that illustrate this problem. The second inconvenient truth is Al Gore's back. And his film has had an enormous influence on all kinds of people. I can't tell you the number of people who have told me, I saw that film and I finally know what all of you have been talking about. We've got to do something. Let's just take a brief look here. These are the top 20 carbon dioxide producers in the world. United States, proud to be number one. China, which we hear a lot about and how we ought to be terrified that if we don't do anything, China's going to wreck the whole world. I mean, they're still way behind us. And on a per capita level, they're way behind us. 6-8-fold less per person in China than in the United States. Then Russia, Japan, Germany, India, Germany, the Northeast. The Northeast. Nine states. New England, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania put us in seventh place there. And you notice we're not that far different from from India, for God's sake, with 1 billion people. It's kind of embarrassing. Here are the emissions in the Northeast region. And I've tried to bring this more to the region because my whole talk is really about how we, as great as it would be to have a great treaty and great as it would be to have national policies, we really need to start at home. And here's our distribution. As you can see, transportation, as Mark said, is our biggest problem. 35%, a little over a third. Electric power generation, our second biggest problem, just under a third. Buildings, commercial and residential, as you can see, about 22%. I mean, I just, as someone who's at a university and knowing people here at MIT, I just can't imagine what this building right here is producing in terms of emissions, but it's a lot. The industrial sector, as we know, has pretty much contracted in New England, and it is not producing that much. But notice that residential emissions are nearly twice as big as commercial emissions from commercial buildings. And yet commercial building codes throughout our entire region are pathetic. Only require 2 inches of insulation in a commercial building. Right? Quick, give me an R7 wall. Right? It's really bad. It's really bad. So we need to address scale. International treaties. We all got very excited when finally Russia ratified and we had the Kyoto Protocol, but let's face it, it's weak. And the report from Nairobi of this past 2 weeks is not encouraging. Nobody seemed to really pick up on it. Only the United Kingdom announced that they will, the agenda for this year is to pass legislation that will reduce emissions substantially. But no other government leader stepped forward to say we're going to do something. National level, non-existent, U.S. States, the Northeast and California, as exciting as Reggie is, as exciting as what is happening in California is, it's modest. It's modest compared to what we need to do. States, most other states, non-existent, nothing happening. Municipalities, some municipalities are taking really strong action. I was talking to somebody from Portland, Oregon recently. They are moving so that all the electricity provided to the entire city of Portland, Oregon, will come from renewable energy sources. Corporations and universities, some have taken very strong actions. I just wish that nations were as far-sighted as some corporations are today. DuPont has reduced their emissions by 72%. Now, admittedly, a lot of those emissions were chemical effluents coming out the stack, which are heat-trapping gases, but they've stopped doing it, and they're moving forward. You've all heard about BP, which is approaching 20% reductions in its operations, and despite the other problems that BP is having up on the North Slope and so on, BP has acknowledged that the emissions they are responsible for directly are only 7% of the total emissions of their product. So they're getting a 20% reduction of 7% of the total product of BP. So they at least acknowledge that and hopefully are moving forward. Finally, individuals. There are individuals who are pushing the limits of what's possible, and that's very exciting. The problem is that we have to figure out how to scale this all up. We need to address timing. Here are just some timing. You know, Kyoto Protocol only goes out to 2012. After that, it ends. If we had succeeded, if the U.S. had been a part of it, we would have reduced emissions of the industrial countries of the world about 5%. We'd have done nothing to offset the emissions coming from the developing world that needs to develop. Queen Elizabeth read the parliamentary agenda for Tony Blair, which is written by Tony Blair, so when she tells him to do it, he wrote it, so probably he'll do it. It's an interesting system they have over there. Very, very different from what we do here in this country. UK is calling for a 60% reduction in emissions by 2050. Back in 2001, and Sonia Hamill was involved in this, the New England governors and Eastern Canadian premiers put together a statement on climate to reduce to 1990 levels by 2010, reduce by 10% below 1990 by 2020, and reduce by 75% to 85% below 2001 in the long term, unspecified. It was the first example I know of where governmental officials looked and said, you know, that's what we really have to do. Now, the good news for politicians is you will not be in office in the long term, right? However, you will have to make the decisions in the short term if we're going to get to the long term. So what is needed to reduce by 75%? Mark called me and said, you know, everybody says we have to reduce by 75%. How can we possibly do that? And I happen to be working on a report with the Union of Concerned Scientists on mitigation, and we are looking at those kind of numbers. And the modeling is showing us if we don't reduce by 75%, we're in big trouble. So here's the solution I'm proposing. I call it the 3% solution. Basically, we need to reduce our emissions by 3% a year throughout the rest of this century. That sounds a lot less terrifying than a 75% reduction, which sounds like you got to do it all at once. Now, what does that, we'll get into what that involves. What that will do is 3% a year, amazingly enough, reduces in half in 23 years. It reduces by to one quarter or by 75% in 46 years. So by the mid-century, we could be down to the 75%. So the UK figure of 60% is maybe only a 2 or 2.5% per year plan. But it isn't put in those terms. So if we think about this in these terms, it becomes less terrifying. And this will assure only if we do this, if we reduce by 3%, assuming that developing countries are going to continue to increase their emissions for a while, and they will, if we don't reduce by 3% a year till mid-century and beyond, by the end of this century, emissions will continue to rise. The concentration in the atmosphere will continue to go up. Only if we do this will the concentrations in the atmosphere be below 1990 levels and heading downward. I mean, it's just a simple stocks and flows argument. It's like having a bank account. If you're putting more, you know, if you're taking more out than you're putting in, the bank account drains. If you're putting more in than you're taking out, the account grows. It's as simple as that. And so we've got to get those numbers right. And so otherwise we'll have these very high temperatures, possibly up to 12 degrees. So what is a 3% reduction per year? Well, it's driving, amazingly enough, the average American drives about 12, or in this region at least, drives about 12,000 miles a year. That's 1,000 miles a month. 3% of 1,000 is 30 miles. Drive 30 miles less each month for a year, and you have indeed reduced your emissions from driving by 3%. That's called personal responsibility. 3% is replacing one 60-watt light bulb with a compact fluorescent lamp each month for 1 year in terms of your electric impact. 3% is eliminating a dorm fridge. I was shocked when we began doing studies at Tufts. You know, we have 4,000 undergraduates. We have whatever it is, 3,000 dorm rooms. We have probably 2,800 dorm fridges. Each dorm fridge consumes about 350 kilowatt hours a year. And those are about, you know, what are they, 2 or 3 cubic feet? Do you know what a 21 cubic foot refrigerator consumes in a year, an Energy Star one? 425. 350 for something this big and 425 for something this big. It's a scandal. It's an outrage. And the U.S. government is blocking the importation of little fridges that use 160 to 100 kilowatt hours a year. And there are no standards for those machines. States, here's an opportunity. And finally, I've just on there, if you replace your pre-1993 fridge with a new Energy Star fridge, you will basically be reducing 3% a year for the life of that refrigerator. So that's a way to do it. Efficiency is the cleanest alternative. It's cleanest and cheapest form of energy. Technological innovation is the path of getting there. Sound policy and knowledge are the drivers. Sound policy is what we need from our state governments. It's what we need from our municipal governments. And knowledge is what all of us need to know how to use this stuff. How to do it? What changes really make a difference? It's not just plastic or paper at the grocery store. You know, it's a lot more that we can be doing, and we need to know that and understand it. And individual action is the implementer. What we do is what makes the difference. With all the treaties in the world, we can wait till, well, I guess hell is never going to freeze over. Is that right? With global warming, hell is never going to freeze over. But we wait a long time, and what will happen is they pass a treaty, our governments do something, and who's going to have to do it? We're going to have to do it. So I think it's important to understand that we're going to have to take the action. Let me give you some amazing facts about energy efficiency. Between 1975 and 2003, so from between the two oil shocks, right after the first one, and 2003, the efficiency equivalent produced in the United States, it was equivalent to about 40% of the energy services in the U.S. relative to the pre-1975 baseline. In other words, if we had stayed on that trajectory, we would have used 40% more energy than we actually used. Right? And, you know, we don't think we did anything, but we did do some things. We did do some things. We set fuel economy standards. We just did all kinds of things. It's an astounding amount. This is almost twice as much as 2003 oil consumption. That saving, not all of it in oil, but it's equivalent in energy terms to almost twice the energy, twice the oil consumption that we did in 2003. It's almost three and a half times as much as net oil imports is what we saved. That's just quite astounding. Energy per dollar of GDP was cut in half. In other words, it only took us half as much energy to produce a dollar worth of GDP in 2003 as it did in 1975. But still our emissions grew because our emissions grew faster than our economy. But the point is we were beginning to see the uncoupling of energy and our emissions. How about relative to other countries? Well, you all know this. You know, Americans consume twice the energy of Germans and Japanese. You know, backward societies like that, where people live primitive lives, freezing in the dark, you know, nothing but a candle to read by. And yet, this is really quite interesting. Residents of the Northeast use only 2/3 as much energy as the average for the United States. Good for us. Yet incomes in the Northeast are the highest in the country. So reducing energy doesn't necessarily make us poorer. In fact, in the Northeast, it is at least probably associated with making us better off economically. Integrated applications can bring large reductions. I think we have to understand that this is not just a piece of technology here and an individual policy there. If you look at the way things fit together, for example, we hear a lot about biofuels. There was a great conference here at MIT last spring, and one of the sessions was biofuels, and it was just fascinating to hear, you know, how, by golly, we can really get off the petroleum spigot to a great extent and so forth. But that will only work and be really effective if we have really efficient automobiles and trucks and buses. So we have to have efficient vehicles, or else we can't plant enough landscape to grow bio crops to make enough fuels to make a real difference. The advantage of biofuels is they suck carbon dioxide out of the air and they put it back in the air, but they don't take carbon out of the ground and put it into the air. So they just recycle the carbon dioxide that's there rather than adding more to it. Maybe one of the few ways we can deal with transportation.
This is the Radio EcoShock Show. Find us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to Professor William Mumaugh of Tufts University, who tells us how to achieve a 75% cut in greenhouse gases.
Cities are moving forward with renewable electric power, and I'll show you a great example here in just a moment. Corporations and universities like MIT are using combined heat and power. You know, it's amazing. The average, we hear about how inefficient power plants are in India and China, and they are. Big, dirty, coal-burning power plants. I just looked up this data the other day because I'm working on the IPCC report on this energy supply piece right now. India, the average power plant is only about 27% efficient. So meaning almost three-quarters of the energy in the coal is just dumped as heat, and only 27% ends up as electricity. In China, it's 33%. In the United States, the average for all coal power plants is 32%. Terrific, right? What is the matter with our engineers and engineering schools? Right? Come on, MIT, my alma mater. Come on, Tufts University, where I am currently teaching. We've got to do better than this. This is just inexcusable. The reason it's so bad in the United States is we have policies that encourage the endurance, the eternal life, if I may say that on a Sunday morning here in Cambridge, of coal-burning power plants. And we have these misguided policies, the grandfathering for emissions and so forth, has led us to keep these dirty, filthy, old, inefficient power plants. The average age of a coal-burning power plant in the United States is circa 1969. We can do better than that. So, and there are zero net emission buildings, apartment buildings and homes being built in the Northeast today. Just very quickly, ethanol from biomass and waste. We can use biodiesel. We can use methanol from waste. By the way, the current price in gasoline per gallon equivalent for methanol is $1.60. You don't hear much about methanol. It can be made from garbage. It can be made from wood chips. It can be made from all kinds of things. That's without any subsidy. That's cheaper than ethanol from corn by a lot. So maybe there's a role for that. We need flexible fuel vehicles. So we need policies that will say you can run them on gasoline. Then when we get some of this methanol in the system or we get some ethanol in the system, your car could run on any of this. We don't have to wait for the hydrogen economy, which in my view may never come. Battery electric vehicles are improving dramatically. Again, a place where we need to do some more research to make those viable. Then we could fill them up with the Hull wind turbine, right? That'd be great. And there it is. Here's what municipalities are doing. Cities and towns and cities like and municipalities like Hull are showing the way. We can't get the big system, the utility system and the suppliers to do this. But there's a law in most states that says you can have a municipal utility. Somebody in Hull figured this out. And they said, you know, we want to have wind turbines, and we can't get these folks over here to do it. So we can do it ourselves because we are a legal entity that can build these things and produce electricity. So those of you who are here in municipalities, think about the incredible flexibility that municipalities have, that the things you can do. You could join with the university or college in your town and have them develop a combined heat and power plant. You could get them to put up wind turbines if they have the land and the wind resources to do it. You can get them to develop a solar utility. You can get them to do all kinds of things that the private utilities will not let you do. It's a great, great example. And I understand they may be the first city to have an offshore, or municipality have an offshore wind park in 2008. Let's hear it for Hull. Just very quickly, combined heat and power, as you know, takes the waste heat, this two-thirds to three-quarters that's thrown away, and uses it for something. MIT has a wonderful combined heat and power system. But the sad thing is they spent, 5 years and $500,000 in lawyers' fees to get it put in place because the local power company objected to it and the laws of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts sided with the utility, not with MIT. BU was given a 10 megawatt fuel cell. They were not allowed to accept it because NSTAR was going to charge them such huge standby charges that they could not afford it. You know, the truth of the matter is that fuel cell is probably 100 times more reliable than any generator in the that feeds into the NSTAR system, and they should be paying BU for a standby charge for reliable energy. But that's why we need to change the glue. I'll just skip over that. Communities, BEDZ. Have any of you heard of this community in the UK? Really interesting. Total private investment in a community whose ultimate goal is to be zero energy from outside the community. And they're starting with buildings, they're moving to transportation, they're moving to agriculture and food production. It's really an incredible concept. And this is a picture of it. It's just gotten started. The first people moved in this past summer. And of the 14 new homes that were occupied in the first round, and this is, this is kind of the Wright brothers version of this concept, used 60% less electricity than the average UK home, and water average was 43% lower. And basically, this lower amount means that they can use solar energy even in more northern than we, UK, to produce electricity for much of this operation. There's a 60-some unit apartment complex being built in the Boston area, which is designed to be incredibly efficient, very efficient walls, windows, doors, and so forth. It's an affordable, middle-income resident community. It will use a combined heat and power biodiesel generator to generate both electricity and heat and hot water. This is being done by a private developer. It also makes substantial use of daylighting, so it will greatly reduce the electricity demand. Passive house in Germany, too much fine print, but starting about 20 years ago, people began to develop things at an institute in Darmstadt, and this shows the results of these passive houses, where on the left you can see the current average for Europe, the energy rating in kilowatt hours per square meter per year, and as you go up here, it's about 275 kilowatt hours per square meter per year. By the time you get down to the passive house, it's about 30, right? That's about 5% of the energy of an average home in the United States. 5%. You can actually meet that extra load with renewables. It's not a problem. As you heard, my wife and I are actually, it's under construction. Hopefully we'll be finished in February. A zero-emission house in New England that will be zero net energy. And it has features like very, R40 walls and R40 and R60 ceilings and really good windows and doors and a ground source heat pump and solar electricity, 7 kilowatts, to make up the deficit. Our house will use less than a quarter of the energy of a standard code house. And then we can meet that. We have enough roof to put that many solar panels on to meet that amount. We don't have enough to do it if we built it to mass code. Could not do it. It would be impossible. So you've got to do it efficiency first and then renewables. That's the order. And that will work really well. And I'm sure that Steve Strong would agree with that when he talks this afternoon. There's some energy heat recovery systems in the air exchanges. There's some recovery systems in the drain water from the shower. It has some all really fun features and uses natural ventilation, daylighting, and other things as well. That's just a picture of the concept. This is just showing the construction of the walls. These are called Larsen trusses. And basically you build a wall and then you build some pockets outside the wall that hold another 8 inches of insulation in order to get the full R40 plus insulating power. All right, universities and university actions. We are sitting in a university. In 1999, the Tufts president, John DiBiagio, made a commitment for Tufts to meet or beat the Kyoto target. Now, that was considered pretty bold back then, and you'll see that there are more bold things being done now, and I'll show you what we've been able to do. There's a major effort to enlist 1,000 universities to focus the nation on climate change in a big thing deal in February 2008, which just happens to coincide with the New Hampshire primaries. I don't think there's anything political here, but if you're at a university, you can go to the website of Focus the Nation and sign up your university and be part of this, and I think it's going to be very exciting. November 8th, I believe it was, a coalition of colleges and university presidents and academic leaders calling on American institutions of higher learning to commit to renewable energy, invest in the industry, and teach future generations about renewable energy. And the chair elected for that is the president of College of the Atlantic, and he's brand new, just came there this year, and they are buying enough outside power and everything to claim that they are actually carbon neutral, the first university to claim so. Here's the new Tufts dorm. It's highly efficient. It has 23 kilowatts of solar PV. Students take solar showers and are therefore cleaner, right, than they would otherwise be. And that's been great, but, you know, we still have a long ways to go. The challenge, I mean, let me just show you. These are our data. We set the goal. Here's our 1990 levels. We have to be 7% below that. The red line is where we have to be. You can see that across there. And you notice that something bad started happening in 2003, 2004. Things started going way up. Well, we like every university president has an edifice complex, right? They got to build buildings. So, you know, our president wanted a building too, and so we got it. And it's a wonderful new science building, and science buildings use more energy than any other building on campus. So, bingo, up goes our carbon emissions. So, notice the dramatic drop that takes place this year. That's because, if you look, the purple is our electricity. What we did was, we negotiated a long-term contract for renewable energy. Now, the interesting thing about this and what sold it to the administration is the future price of new hydropower and new wind power is probably not going to change for the indefinite future. That fuel price is fixed at zero. Right? The capital cost is already in place. We know what that is. We paid a slightly higher price, and we got certainty over the life of the contract. And then the surge in natural gas prices occurred, and we looked really good. Our price was below what everybody else was having to pay. So now we're back within striking distance, but you can see we're projecting this little trend upwards here, and we're going to have to figure out. We only have two more years to 2012 at the end of that to get ourselves down to that 7% below 1990 level. It's not easy, but you can work at it and make some differences. States and cities. I notice in the information here, it says, for example, for cities and towns, enforce the building code. You know, as Sarah Creighton at Tufts University, who's head of our sustainability effort, says, whenever the facilities people say, you know, she wants them to do something really neat with a building and make it more efficient, she says, well, we're meeting code. And her comment is, well, that's keeping you out of jail. We need to do better than that. We need a new building code. My contractor, who has built Energy Star houses before he built mine, I asked him, how much more efficient are they than code houses? And he said, about 30%. And I said, how much more does that cost your clients? He said, about nothing. 30% below the Massachusetts code costs nothing. Come on, we need a better code. There's no question about it. We need a new code. We need to train and certify architects. Finding an architect who knows how to do this is not easy. There's a small number of them. Finding a contractor who knows how to do this is not easy. Finding subcontractors who know how to do this, electricians who know how to put in electrical services and not puncture the air sealant system of the house when they do so, is not easy. So we need some training. I'm not ragging on these guys. They're doing their job the way they've always done their job. But they've got to do the job differently, and we need to help them do that differently so that the default is what we need, not what has been. And this whole business, we've got to have new rules on combined heat and power and distributed energy and so forth. The state rules are just a scandal in terms of how difficult it is to do the right thing that would reduce emissions dramatically. We clearly need to encourage compact development and discourage sprawl, and we need to take, as cities and states, the lead in purchasing, as Mark said, low and zero emission electricity, efficient vehicles, and standards in public buildings. Universities, here's my call. Come on, engineering schools, we need to do better. I know that nano, bio, micro, photo, whatever is all the rage. But you know, we live in macro spaces. that need macro solutions. So we need systems engineering. We need a way to think about these things in a way that's actually going to have practical consequences. We do need to do research, and MIT should be congratulated on choosing a energy transformative climate protecting energy technologies as part of that is really essential. And then each university must set an example through their own operations. Individuals, and I'm going to be pretty heavy-handed here. We need to take responsibility for our own actions and reduce our carbon footprint. We need to become, that's not consumers, consumers. I was thinking of consumers there. Need to become responsible consumers. We don't have to buy the most energy-consuming thing. Maybe there are a lot of things we don't even need to buy, but when I see pictures of hundreds of people waiting for the latest electronic play game for 3 days in the rain, I just don't know what to make of all that. Can they at least put them so that they run on solar energy or something? I don't know. There's got to be a way. As responsible citizens, we need to push our political leaders and say, we want more. We don't want that where we are. We want to be in a different place. And we need to convince people at our place of work and our employers to make a difference. Now, let me just finish here. This was in the newspaper. It was in the Boston Globe. I chose the internet version from the Taipei Times. Just to indicate you, this has gotten global notice. This weekend at Moffett Field, California, NASA's Ames Research Center hosts a closed-door, high-level workshop on the global haze proposal and other geoengineering ideas for fending off climate change. This is the idea to send tons of sulfur dioxide and sulfate particles up into the stratosphere to reflect the sun away, much as Mount Pinatubo did a number of years ago, in order to reduce global warming. Aside from the fact that this would give a whole new global context to acid rain, the amounts would have to cut about 20% of solar intensity, and I wonder, in a growing world, what that does for agriculture. Last time I looked, photosynthesis was linear with sunlight intensity. Paul Crutzen, a Nobel Prize winner who helped solve the ozone depletion problem, said this to say when he published his proposal. He cited a grossly disappointing international political response to warming, and it was meant to startle the policymakers. If they don't take action much more strongly than they have in the past, then in the end we have to do experiments like this. So he's not happy about it. He's a little shocked that the whole idea has taken on this kind of credibility, which he doesn't believe in. Now, we don't need to be quite so pessimistic. There are plenty of opportunities. I've illustrated a few of those for you. We can do things. We need policy at all levels, but it is simpler and faster to get those at the state and municipal level. So let's start there. It is important to get national policy and international treaties, but these are most likely to come from the bottom up. I don't see this happening, that somehow some great group of wise people will get together in the world and solve this problem for us. I think it's going to have to start with us, go up through our municipalities and states, and through our companies and universities, and eventually what we will find is that we need to scale up, we need to push for changes in policies at state and local levels, we need to push for changes in policy at the federal level, but don't hold your breath. But we cannot wait for any policies. Why stop at 75%? Right? That doesn't put us in a great place, by the way. If you look at the total amount of concentrations we would have at the end of the century, even if we reduced by 75%, it's going to be a warmer and much less pleasant world. And we need to act now. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a speech by Professor William Moomaw, spelled Moomaw, a climate expert from Tufts University. The title was, How Can We Utilize Technologies and Policies to Get Us to a 75% Cut in Global Warming Emissions? This speech is part of a double DVD set, a video of the conference available from the MCAN website at www.massclimateaction.org. The featured presentation was by Boiling Point author and journalist Ross Gelbspan. 450 people attended MCAN's 5th Global Warming Action Conference on Sunday, November 19, 2006, at MIT's Strata Center, making it one of the largest climate protection events in the U.S. so far. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio, your voice in Vancouver. It's a big world, and we need to look outside the West to see what is happening elsewhere. As you know, India is catching up to China as one of the world's fastest-growing economies. With little population control, it will also have more people than China by the middle of this century. One in every five people on Earth will be of East Indian descent. Now we're going to listen to one voice from this complex subcontinent. Satish Kumar, the editor of Resurgence magazine, speaks about Gandhi and environmentalism. For those who don't know, Mahatma Gandhi was the spiritual and political leader of the Indian movement, which gained independence from Britain. To reduce dependence on British industrial products, he proposed a Made in India policy and a simple lifestyle not based on consumerism. Of course, Gandhi was much more than this, too much to tell in this short time. We will hear selections from the speech, which I picked up from a radio program produced by and for kids called Radio Free School. Here is Satish Kumar speaking on Gandhi in the Age of Climate Change.
So we have built an economy of free market and globalization. Simply put, free market and globalization is the cause of global warming. If we want to reduce global warming, we want to mitigate climate change, it is not going to happen by technological fixes. It is going to happen when we are prepared to have a new world view and a new way of life, what Mahatma Gandhi advocated. The new world view has to be based in our relationship with the natural world. A relationship of respect and reverence. A reverential ecology, or a spiritual ecology, or a non-violent ecology, where nature is not there for our use. There is an intrinsic value of nature, or in nature. Trees are there, standing. They are useful to us because they give us fruit, they give us shade, they give us wood, they give us oxygen, and therefore we value them. But there's a more value to the trees and to the forest and to the lakes and to the mountains and to the animals and birds and all life than their usefulness to humans. So recognizing the intrinsic value of nature, that is the first big shift, paradigm shift we have to make. This idea of human superiority and all the rest of the species and nature for the benefit and use of humans, that has to change. We have to have an equity with nature, an understanding, a relationship with nature, where trees have as much right. Your lake here, the wonderful Ontario Lake, has as much right to remain clean, unpolluted water as your home. You have right to have your home unpolluted. You would not like me to come and throw my rubbish bin into the courtyard or living room of your house. If I do not have right to put my rubbish in your living room, what right I or you have to put our rubbish into the living room of the lake or living room of the forest? So throwing waste in nature and using nature for our benefit, that fundamental attitude change, a paradigm shift has to be there if we really wish to mitigate the effects of climate change. And the second, we have to develop a positive view of living in harmony with the natural world. Living in harmony in such a way that we live happily but not wastefully. We live elegantly and simply, but not extravagantly. This extravagant, wasteful lifestyle which we have built, as if there is no tomorrow. Gandhi came to believe that a simple life is a freer life. When we have this kind of materialistic society and materialistic culture, this creates more bondage and less freedom. We think that we are a free society just because we can write an article in New York Times or your Globe and Mail, or just because you can publish some books, you are free. freedom is much more than just saying something. And therefore, if you truly want to be free, then you have to be simple. It's blessed to be free, and it's blessing to be simple, and it's a blessing to be free. That is a Gandhian idea. So, living a simple, elegant lifestyle, less and local. That was Gandhi's idea of Swadeshi. Gandhi coined three beautiful ideas. The first was Sarvodaya. Sarvodaya is different from socialism and capitalism. The two dominant philosophies in our political system and political thinking is socialism and capitalism. Socialism is concerned with the benefit of society, human society, purely anthropocentric political philosophy. And capitalism, even less. It's not even concerned about society, it's concerned about the capital. As long as your capital is safe, you are happy. So capitalism and socialism both do not take nature into account. So Mahatma Gandhi coined a new word, and that word was Sarvodaya, well-being of all. All, literally all. Even in socialism, you do not have the idea of all human beings. The socialist idea is greatest good of the greatest number. Whereas Sarvodaya says, not greatest good of the greatest number, but greatest good of all numbers. And that greatest good should begin with the weakest of the weak, poorest of the poor. When you start to bring development, economic development, where do you start? You start with the poorest of the poor and the weakest of the weak. So Gandhi started to work with the untouchables. And how do you start to work with the untouchables? Not just by preaching at them and telling them what to do and how to live, but identifying with them. Gandhi said, how it is that I go to toilet and then somebody else, an untouchable, comes and cleans it. So Gandhi started to clean the toilets. Gandhi took a broom in his hand and went out from his ashram and cleaned the streets. That way he incorporated the principle of Sarvodaya, the well-being and upliftment of all. And that included not only humans, but other than human species. If there is no well-being of the animals, the way our farming works, the factory farming, that is not non-violent. And you cannot have Sarvodaya if the animals are treated with cruelty. And so, well-being of all includes the welfare of animals and forests. If you go and clear-cut rainforest in Amazon to grow more corn or soya so that you can make biofuels, or you can have hamburgers or something mass-produced, that is violence to the forest. Forests have rights, as I said before. We have human rights. Gandhian thinking will lead you to understand rights of nature. And so Sarvodaya brings that holistic philosophy into our politics and sociology so that we give right to all living beings and well-being of all living beings, humans and other than humans. The second principle Mahatma Gandhi pronounced and propagated was Swaraj. A Hindi word, Swaraj. Swaraj means self-organized governance. Governance not coming from top to bottom, someone telling you how you live, but Swaraj where communities, villages, towns, neighborhoods, and individuals and families, they bring governance which is self-organized. This is how nature works. This is where we need to learn from nature, the wisdom of nature. How the forests are organizing? Is there any military force there? Do they have any courts? How lions and tigers and snakes and eagles and birds, how they organize their governance? Do they have any president or prime minister or parliament? When 300 million species on the earth can run their lives beautifully, and there is no hunger in nature, no species are starving, going to bed without food. Only human species have systems of government in which millions of people are forced to go to bed without food. How it is that we consider ourselves superior species? The tigers, the deer, the snakes, the birds, the eagle, they are all fed and watered and sheltered without any help of supermarkets or Monsanto or Cargill or genetic engineering of seeds. And we humans cannot organize ourselves in such a way that every human being has access to food and water and shelter. And the third idea of Gandhi, Sarvodaya and Swaraj, and the third is Swadeshi, the local home economy, as Gary mentioned in his introduction. Home economy, where your economics, maximum economics is local. No transportation, as I said before, local. If there is a trade, Gandhi was not an extremist. In no way he was extremist. He would say, if you want to do some trade, it should be in goods which are not available locally. And that should be icing on the cake. Small amount. So not too much transportation required. So maximum economic activity is at the local grassroots level. In your villages, in your towns, in your neighborhoods, in your within 50 miles, 100 miles, when you can travel, walk, go on horses, or have a small public transportation, or bus, or train, or something. But this huge, big lorries traveling from north, south, to south, east, to west, from California east of the eastern part of America, or Vancouver to Ottawa, or somewhere, long distance is traveling of goods. Gandhi said, that's not Swadeshi. That's not a proper, sustainable, durable economy. Durable economy is one which is always renewable and local and available, and you have control over it. So that is the third idea of Gandhi, which I think these three ideas of Sarvodaya, Swaraj and Swadeshi. The upliftment and well-being of all, without any exception, no one is left out, completely inclusive development is Sarvodaya. And Swaraj is self-organizing from inside out, from self-managed system. You learn from nature and develop your governance on the principles of Swaraj. And Swadeshi, your economy. So you can see on a philosophical level, political level, and economic level, he has a whole new vision, a whole new paradigm in which sustainability is inbuilt. And Gandhi was talking at the time when nobody was talking about environment, and nobody was worried about global warming. But now we can see the relevance of Gandhian way of thinking in our age of global warming. We are industrial system, so busy that the industrial system, violent system, has taken out the beauty and joy from our lives. That is the reason, global warming or no global warming, climate change or no climate change, resources depletion or no resources depletion. This kind of industrial way of life is not, from Gandhian perspective, which he spoke nearly 80 years ago, or nearly 100 years ago. His first book, Hind Swaraj, came out in 1909. So nearly we are reaching 100 years ago, when he talked about what is a satisfactory, good way of living. So Gandhian idea is not driven from fear. The modern environmentalism is very much driven by fear. Fear of doom and gloom, and disaster, Global warming will bring an end to the civilization. Therefore, we have to do something. If you act out of fear, your action will be panic-driven. And then you will very easily fall from frying pan to fire. You will go from fossil fuel to nuclear fuel. You will go from fossil fuel to biofuel. And a biofuel, when people are starving, we want to make fuel from corn and soya to feed our cars. That's it. Unjust social order we will create. So panic-driven solutions will be there if we are driven by fear. So Gandhian nonviolence talks about action, environmentalism, economy, our way of life, not driven from fear, but from love of nature, love of life, love of the earth, love of people. If you have love in your heart for trees and animals and birds and lakes and rivers and people and communities and children, then your action will be right action. And so I would say, friends, that in this age of climate change and global warming, love-driven action is essential. Without that, we will come into a sorry state.
Those were selections from a speech given by Satish Kumar, editor of Resurgence magazine, speaking on Gandhi in the age of climate change. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. As always, you can find lots more free downloads of Great Green Audio on our website at www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, and thanks for listening. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. True listener-supported radio. Help us stay on the air by becoming a member. Just phone 604-684-8494. Or sign up online at www.cooperadio.org. That's coopradio.org. It's a cheap way to keep commercial-free radio coming your way with music, news, and talk you won't hear anywhere else. Co-op Radio in Vancouver.